Istorija se ovdje ne ponavlja. Istorija ovdje traje.
This evening, the program shall be presented to you in English, Zulu and Sotho by comrades Mahlomola Tau, Edward Dube and Richmond Ramotse. Now stand by.
Dekolonizacija radijskih valov.
We dare to rise up above the limits of kitchen life. We emerged out of the belly of imperialism and reaction. Proud wives of loving husbands whose courage slavery has failed to destroy.
Drage poslušalke, dragi poslušalci, lepo pozdravljeni na valovih Radija Študent. Gost nocojšnje oddaje Repetitio je Sekiba Kiba Peter Lehkvati, predavatelj na Univerzi Witwatersrand v Johannesburgu, ki se raziskovalno posveča razvoju režimskih in gverilskih radijev v Republiki Južni Afriki. Na špičite ušesa.
So, the topic of today's discussion are guerrilla radios in Southern Africa. To begin with, what are guerrilla radios and how do they differ from other types of radios one might come across in Southern Africa?
We use the concept guerrilla radios in relation to the radios of the liberation struggle in Southern Africa. A guerrilla is a freedom fighter. So these are the radios that were the mouthpieces of the liberation movements that fought or white settler regimes, white minority regimes, or white colonial regimes in the region. That's the meaning of the concept.
And which type of questions about the history of liberation movements in Southern Africa does focusing on guerrilla radios help to answer?
Well, I mean, it's really a question of trying to say these guerrilla movements were actually operating outside the countries which were actually fighting the liberation struggle, because they couldn't operate from within those particular territories. So the question, you know, that troubled us, that we wanted to really deal with, was to find out how did these liberation movements link up with the masses of the people in the countries. That was an important historical question for us, to say, you know, these liberation movements, which were illegal, I mean, they were banned in South Africa, in Namibia, in Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Angola, and other places, they were banned and they operated from other countries. In South Africa, for instance, when the ANC, the African National Congress, and the Pan-Africanist Congress and other liberation movements were banned, they moved into the neighboring countries that were already independent. from where they launched the struggle against apartheid South Africa. So that for us was an important question to say, how did they link up? How did these liberation movements send their messages to the masses in the country? And how did those masses listen to this radio, which was operating from exile locations, considering that it was banned in those countries, such as South Africa? So how did they actually connect with the listeners? And what sort of support did these guerrilla radios receive from these neighboring African countries, but also from other countries? I mean, this the liberation struggle in Southern Africa operates in the context of the Cold War. And so, you know, it does get a lot of support from, you know, the Eastern Bloc, that is from particularly from the Soviet Union. That's part of our investigation, looked at raised those kind of questions. But in relation to radio more specifically, it really revolved around the propaganda. How did they manage to get their propaganda across to their supporters inside the country? Because you are dealing here with, you know, the apartheid state also having using radio as a channel of propaganda. But let me also say, radio is not the only medium that was being used. It's just that in terms of our focus on the radio project, our focus was really to focus on radio broadcasting to see what role it played in the liberation struggle.
When we think of historiographical research, one might, maybe unjustifiably so, immediately think of old dusty documents hidden away in some archives, just waiting for a historian to read them and analyze them. But radio, by its very conception, is a medium which utilizes sound as its primary mode of conveying information. So how does one research the history of a radio, and of all types, a guerrilla radio?
Archives are clearly very important, but radio is a medium, you know, it's an audio medium. Basically, you use audio. And so while, you know, there are documentary sources, I don't think, you know, those documentary sources are enough as a basis for writing about radio. That is one element. Yes, here and there are fragments of documentary sources. For example, in relation to the work on guerrilla radio in South Africa, Radio Freedom in particular, which was the mouthpiece of the ANC, you know, there is an archive of documentary sources that is available. It's called the Liberation Archive. It's at the University of Fort Hare in the Eastern Cape. But the most important sources are really the audio archives, which are also have been deposited in the archives. At the University of the Western Cape, there's the Robben Island and Maibuye Archive Center, where the audio materials generated by Radio Freedom in the form of, you know, the radio programs themselves and the interviews have actually been deposited at this archive. So it's very, very important to use the audio archives because they actually give you a sense of the sonic elements of the radio at the time. I need to also point out that particularly guerrilla radio, dealing with radios that were, well, you know, these radios as part of the illegal or banned liberation movements couldn't operate freely. And so it's very difficult to find records of meetings that took place. And in fact, political activists operated in an underground way. So they tended to commit a lot of the things, you know, that they had to the mind, to the memory, rather than put down on paper, because keeping papers leaves a trail that could actually get not only you, but other compatriots in the struggle into trouble. They could get arrested. So quite often the word of mouth is very, very important, which is why in our research, we have conducted a lot of interviews with former radio broadcasters of these guerrilla radios, also the managers, people who worked as managers but also the broadcasters of the host radio stations. I personally did with my collaborator, with my co-author, recently actually conducted interviews in Zambia. I'm sure you are aware, Zambia played a key role in the struggle, you know, against white minority rule in Southern Africa, in Zimbabwe, in Mozambique, and other places, Namibia. It hosted these liberation movements and actually provided airtime and studios where these radios could broadcast, could produce, you know, their programs and actually broadcast from the national broadcaster, or rather on the external services, the national broadcaster of Zambia, to these particular regions that were still fighting white minority rule. That is how I would actually respond to the question of archives, that it is very important to conduct those interviews, because a lot of, you know, a lot of material has not been written down. The situation in many instances didn't allow for recording of minutes and so forth. So, and hence, you know, it is very important to find people who worked on these radios and conduct interviews.
Now, if we turn from methodological questions, when do guerrilla radios emerge in Southern Africa, and what drives their creation, and what goals do they attempt to achieve?
Obviously, for different countries, it would be different times. But generally, it's in the 1960s, when after the Second World War, you know, there's this growing nationalist agitation in Africa, right? In Southern Africa, more specifically, you know, this call for decolonization, this agitation and mobilization is actually met with brute force. Particularly in the settler colonies of South Africa, you know, Namibia, Mozambique, Angola, and others. In other words, in areas where there were large populations of European settlers, they tended to push back against, you know, African aspirations for independence, for decolonization. And they did so violently. You know, you find police actually shooting at people. So you've got a series of massacres in the region. So I think if I could give an example, in South Africa in 1960, on the 21st of March, black people in the township of Sharpeville, which is located more than 50 or 60 kilometers from Johannesburg, south of Johannesburg, actually marched against pass laws. Well, in South Africa, you know, black people were forced to carry passes. These are documents which were used as a system of, you know, influx control, which were intended to keep black people outside of white areas, outside of the cities, and to allow only a limited number of them. So these passes were, of course, extended to women in the 1950s, and come the 1960s. So there's a campaign which was spearheaded by the liberation movements. But then the actual march that took place on that 21st March 1960 was organized by the Pan-Africanist Congress, PAC, in Sharpeville. And the march was a non-violent march. It was a peaceful march. People marched to the police station, to the local police station in Sharpeville, to surrender themselves so that they'd be arrested. They were not carrying passes. They were saying, we don't carry passes. In fact, some had even burned, you know, they torched their passes. So that was the campaign to defy apartheid. And they were basically inviting the police to arrest them. But then the police responded by firing at them. A lot of people were killed. Official statistics back in the day said 69 people. But research is emerging that it's actually much more than that number. It's about 80-something or 90 or so. But that's really what actually triggered the turn to the armed struggle. So after the shooting, and then, of course, this liberation movements, the PAC, the ANC, and others were banned, you know, they were prohibited, and the leaders of those political movements were arrested. And so, you know, peaceful means of fighting against apartheid were met with violence. And that is what actually led to the decision to go underground, to establish an armed wing, hoping to bring about violent revolution. And so then in South Africa in 1963, the ANC ANC felt that you actually needed a medium, a powerful medium, to be able to propagate your ideas so that you can disseminate your ideas. So they established a pirate radio on a farm that the Liberation Movement had bought. It was the ANC with the support of the South African Communist Party. They bought this farm in a place called Rivonia, which was a small holding farm just north of Pretoria, about 10 miles from the city of Johannesburg, 10 miles north of the city of Johannesburg. And this is where the high command of Umkhonto we Sizwe is the armed wing of the ANC, the military wing, basically. And Umkhonto we Sizwe means the spear of the nation. That's the literal translation. So that's where the high command actually took refuge. And then the idea of actually establishing radio, this is where it came up, just conceptualized. And even the recording of the first broadcast of this pirate radio called Freedom Radio at the time, or Liberation Radio, it was hatched there. It was actually conceptualized there, and the recording took place there. But within 2 weeks of this first broadcast, there was a raid by the police on the farm. They found out, using, of course, a network of informers, they found out and actually arrested all, the high command that was taking refuge there. That is in 1963, in June. And that began a whole series, right? A whole series of the prosecutions, the trials, and ultimately long sentences, life sentences that were given to leaders such as Walter Sisulu, Ahmed Kathrada, and others who joined Nelson Mandela, of course, who was already in jail at the time. So in short, just to go back to your question about when, so it's in the 1960s, early 1960s. As a result, so the guerrilla radios were established in response to the brutal force used by the white minority regimes to suppress legitimate aspirations for political rights, for the vote, for equal rights in those countries, and or rather in those colonies. And it left them with no choice but to actually embark on the armed struggle. But in order to successfully launch an armed struggle, you also needed access to the airwaves. And that's why this liberation movement established guerrilla radios, which was, of course, illegal, because in colonial governments, which were established in the region, the media, especially radio, was the monopoly of the state. It was the monopoly of the colonial government. So establishing a pirate radio, a guerrilla radio, was illegal. Hence, people who were found to have established those radios were actually arrested. And of course, once this leaders were arrested in South Africa in Rivonia at a farm called Lily's Leaf Farm, those that managed to slip away, those that managed to escape, skipped the country and found refuge in neighboring countries. They went to Tanzania, which was already independent at the time, and they went to other countries. And as I'm sure you are aware, the 1960s was a very important decade for African countries. Many African colonies became independent in the 1960s. And they were among those countries, those that were willing to host and provide support to the liberation movements, with, of course, a lot of military and financial support from the Eastern Bloc, and increasingly also, as the year went on, also from non-aligned.
And how did these goals of broadcasting anti-apartheid messages, how did these goals influence the program of the radio? Can you maybe describe a bit what the program of the radio sounded like?
There would be different programs. On Radio Freedom, there were programs that looked at what was actually happening in South Africa. Some of these programs were actually a response to the apartheid state's propaganda, kind of providing counter-propaganda. So there were news bulletins, and the news bulletins provided a counter narrative of the narrative that the apartheid state propaganda gave, right? It gave information about kind of political education, could put it like that. It informed the campaigns when there were campaigns that the liberation movement was embarking on. For example, if I could give an example, in the 1980s, when the apartheid regime introduced a tricameral parliamentary system, which was a system that allowed or created space for Indians, that is South Africans of Indian heritage who came from, their ancestors came from India in the 1860s and settled in South Africa, as well as coloureds. There's a category called coloured in South Africa. These are people of mixed heritage, people who mixed, Europeans, the early Dutch settlers got into relationships with local Khoisan women, as well as the slaves from Asia, from Malaysia more specifically. It led to the development of a colored category. Now, the apartheid state in the early 1980s decided to extend the franchise, the right to vote, to colors and Indians. It's called a tricameral parliamentary system. And so the liberation movement launched a formidable campaign against this tricameral parliamentary system, exposing that it was actually a fraud. And so there was a program on Radio Freedom that talked about this tricameral parliamentary system and how much of a fraud it was. And of course, at that time also, you have a mobilization also happening inside the country. So you've got the formation of the United Democratic Front. So you've got this campaign, you've got these programs on radio that are saying, you know, the tricameral parliament system should be boycotted. And that was linked with the campaigns that were actually being engaged in inside the country against this system. So that is one. Other programs revolved around rent boycotts. I mean, the 1980s was really a decade when the liberation movement decided to, you know, render apartheid ungovernable. So you render apartheid ungovernable by basically defying everything about apartheid. For example, the people in the townships were mobilized and encouraged or urged to boycott paying rent for their houses, which were owned by the municipalities. So Radio Freedom actually played an important role in terms of mobilizing the people against apartheid, making sure that the system was actually rendered unworkable and ungovernable, and in that way put pressure on the apartheid regime to get to the negotiating table with the ANC and other liberation movements, which actually happened starting in 1990.
You also said that basically apartheid regime implements this classification of its people into four main categories, right?
Yes.
And you said that in 1980s, they sort of claimed to also give the voting rights to the colored people and to the Indians, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
Excluding the black population.
Excluding the Africans, the black population. That's correct.
So it's basically a fairly diverse population. Does this play a role in, for instance, who the radio tries to address and which languages it uses?
Yeah, absolutely. The issue of audience or listenership is something that the Radio Freedom was really concerned with. It made sure that in the beginning, you know, it was broadcasting like in the 1960s. It seems to have been broadcasting only in English, but come the early 1970s, there's a decision that was taken that Radio Freedom should broadcast in a multiplicity of languages in the country. So English remained a dominant language because there was this idea that it reached a lot of people. But then there was also a problem of illiteracy. So not all people in South Africa understands English. So English is virtually a language of the educated elite. And it was on that basis that there was the introduction of African languages, and which is something that, of course, you know, the apartheid regime was already doing. In 1960, the apartheid regime introduced African language radio called Radio Bantu on the SABC in the different languages like Radio Zulu, Radio Xhosa, Radio Tswana, Radio Northern Sotho, and so forth and so forth, as a way of dividing up people. But then the ANC actually took that up to say, well, we need to be able to speak directly to the people in their own languages. And hence, in I think it was around 1973, the ANC on Radio Freedom actually said that it was very important that, you know, it focuses on broadcasting in these African languages as well, including Afrikaans, by the way. Afrikaans, which was a language of the, you know, of the ruling Afrikaner National Party. This was the language of the rulers. But at the same time, the ANC felt, you know, of course, we need to also get, you know, white people to listen to Radio Freedom. We also need to get colored people, many of whom spoke Afrikaans as a home language. They also need to listen to Radio Freedom. So Radio Freedom was, of course, made accessible, or rather broadcasting was done in Afrikaans as well, in order to, you know, for these different audiences to get the message from the ANC, to know what the ANC is actually saying in their own words. I think you see the same thing in Zimbabwe as well, where the two liberation movements, ZANU and ZAPU, also made sure that broadcasting is done not only in English, but of course English played an important role, but also in local languages, particularly Ndebele and Shona. And in Namibia as well, the same thing would actually apply with the local, major local languages. The Voice of Namibia would actually make sure that, you know, it reaches out to its audiences, not only in English, but also in the local languages. So, you know, it was very clear that the audiences are the local people. So you don't want to have any language barrier there. So programming, whether it's news programs, and I've talked about news as an important element, you know, it had to be made available, this news had to be made available in indigenous languages as well. And on top of that, there were of cultural programs, particularly music. Because, you know, the view of the liberation movement was that culture is a weapon of the struggle. So music, particularly music that was quite political in terms of its content, was given priority on Radio Freedom. You know, broadcasting, it is not just the news, but you've got current affairs programs where there's an analysis of what is actually going on from the perspective of the liberation movement of that particular radio. If it's Radio Zimbabwe, the Voice of Zimbabwe, that was the mouthpiece of the of ZANU, Zimbabwe African National Union. And then if it's ZAPU, Zimbabwe African People's Union, that would be the voice of the revolution, the voice of the revolution. So these radios have had different names. So yeah, that's the long and short of it. Then culture, you know, a lot of, or many artists, particularly black artists whose music was political, ended up skipping the country and going into exile. And I mean, the examples would include here, Miriam Makeba, you know, Jonas Kwangwa, the likes of Hugh Masekela. They went into exile and they continue to produce music, Kefa Siminya, Leta Mbulu, and others. And their music was not getting any airplay inside the country because they were banned. These were banned artists. But on Radio Freedom, their music, because of its political content, because it addressed, it attacked apartheid, was given airplay. And so the people listening to this radio inside South Africa, and I think which is something that we need to talk about, how people listen to this radio. But the people listening to this radio would actually be listening to this political content, which actually inspired them to keep on struggling against apartheid. Yeah, I mean, that's how I would actually respond to the issue of audiences. And of course, you know, there were young people and old people. There was also interestingly on Radio Freedom, a religious program. On Sundays, for example, there would be someone who's acting as a priest. Of course, there were people who were religious, who were Christian, who ended in exile. So they were also brought in as broadcasters and they would give sermons. So you've got a variety of programs. So, you know, this radio, in terms of its programming, it had a whole lineup of programs. You know, this would be covered on Monday, this would be covered on Tuesday, this would be covered on Wednesday, and so forth and so forth. As you know, Ethiopia, Addis Ababa was the headquarters of the Organization of African Unity. So the developments in the OAU would also be covered, something that would not really get positive coverage on the South African Broadcasting Corporation, that is the SABC, right? So, but the ANC would actually make sure that whatever is happening at the OAU would find positive coverage on Radio Freedom. So, and whenever there are important speeches that are given by the leaders of the ANC, they would be recorded and then played on Radio Freedom. It was really about ensuring that there's a link between the ANC in exile and the people in the country who supported this organization. And in that way, people continue to be inspired, knowing that the liberation movement such as the ANC exists out there. I'm speaking largely about the ANC because that's my area of interest. That's what I've actually written quite extensively on.
You said that you focused specifically at ANC radios, which says that there were more radios.
In South Africa, you had another guerrilla radio, which has not been spoken about. And this is the PAC's radios, Voice of the PAC, which was also supported by in some independent African countries. But it was not as visible as the ANC's radio. The ANC's Radio Freedom was more visible. I think, you know, if many people were actually listening to it, particularly younger people, but people who were quite involved in the struggle, because it was illegal to listen to it. So there was some kind of secrecy around listening to this, because you wouldn't want to be caught listening to Radio Freedom. If you were caught and prosecuted and found guilty, you could go to jail for up to 8 years. So it was definitely something that many people who listened to Radio Freedom didn't take lightly. Hence, they listened to this radio in secret. They listened to it in groups because it was often very difficult to listen to it. You needed a particular kind of radio set to listen to it. In South Africa in the 1960s, there was this mass production of cheap radio sets which only allowed you access to FM only. Frequency modulation is kind of limited. You can only access the radio up to a certain extent. It was easily obstructed by visible elements like mountains and so forth. And part of the reason why there was this collusion between the manufacturers, that is capital, and the state was in part the desire on the part of the state to limit, you know, African or rather black audiences, black listeners' access to foreign hostile radios like Radio Freedom, like BBC. BBC was seen as hostile because it didn't toe the line of the apartheid regime. It talked about things that the apartheid state didn't want people in South Africa to listen to. And so hence they introduced the FM-only radio sets. So the radio sets that allowed one access to shortwave and medium wave were limited and in short supply. Hence people often who had those radio sets would get into groups with others. And the listeners, when they were tuning into this radio, particularly Radio Freedom, would make sure that the volume is very, very low. Some people talk about covering themselves with blankets at night in order to limit, you know, the voice from going out. Because people who were involved in the struggle against apartheid were always scared of informers. You know, there was this very complex network of informers, those people who informed the apartheid state and led to the arrest of people. So those are some of the practices that actually happened. Maybe I could add something about how, because it operated in secret, right? It was a clandestine radio. How did people know how to tune into Radio Freedom? In a sense, you had to be an activist to know how to tune in. It was through information disseminated by the liberation movement that people knew how to tune into Radio Freedom. So there were certain publications that were banned publications in the country, but they somehow found their way into the country. So they were smuggled into the country. Publications such as Sechaba, that was the ANC's monthly journal. The front page, or rather the page immediately after the cover page, this page, or sometimes even the last page, would have, you know, information about Radio Freedom and how to tune into Radio Freedom. The frequency, it will give you the times as well as to when to switch into Radio Freedom. Something that I have not talked about here is the fact that Radio Freedom operated from different African countries. So it wasn't just located in Zambia, in Lusaka in Zambia, but it was also broadcasting from Tanzania, from Madagascar for a while, from 1979, I think, to 1982. It was also broadcasting from Madagascar. After Angola became independent in 1975, I think it started operating from Angola in 1977. It also operated from Ethiopia, from Dar es Salaam. So you see, it was operating from these different places at different times. So that if, for example, between 7 and 7:30 in the evening, it was broadcasting from Lusaka, perhaps from 7:30 to 8:00, it would be operating from Ethiopia. But, you know, it was always broadcasting into South Africa, where many people were listening to it. And it managed to do so because it was broadcasting from shortwave. You see, shortwave has got a larger reach. Someone explained how shortwave actually operates. It's almost like putting a hose pipe straight up and then opening it full blast. The water kind of comes out like this, right? You could be broadcasting from South Africa here, and someone in Tokyo, Japan, would actually be hearing you. That's the kind of reach that it has. Unlike FM, that is frequency modulation, which is why the South African state did not want, in fact, not just the South African state, but the white minority regimes in the region did not like this radio sets that had shortwave on them, because it enabled people to get access to this, you know, hostile radios that are coming from outside that were broadcasting on shortwave. So that was part of the reason why they had to limit access, actually eradicate, stop the production of radio sets that had shortwave on them.
And to finish off, what happens to guerrilla radios when they achieve their political goals? Do they simply cease to exist, or are they reshaped and incorporated into the new political realities?
In many Southern African countries, they ceased to exist. They actually, the staff got incorporated into the existing, you know, national radios. They kind of took over from the colonial radios and reshaped those colonial radios into post-colonial radios that were primarily controlled. Ideologically, they were aligned to the ruling party. Of course, that did not happen in South Africa, although the ANC tried to do that. Clearly, when Radio Freedom, or rather when the space was created for negotiations in 1990 in South Africa, Radio Freedom continued to exist until 1992, but then actually closed. I think the last broadcast to take place was in Tanzania in 1992. And so all the broadcasters came back and they were absorbed into various positions in the SABC, which I think was short-sighted on the part of the ANC. To stop broadcasting, they should have kept Radio Freedom to operate and to give the ANC's perspective on things, rather than try to infiltrate the SABC and hoping that it would somehow manage to capture the SABC. The SABC is a national broadcaster. Clearly, under apartheid, the SABC was captured by the National Party government and it became a state broadcaster. But as transition was actually happening, there was a lot of discussion in South Africa around what the SABC should be like. And so there was a strong call for the SABC to go back to being the public broadcaster, which it is right now, right? And there have, of course, been attempts by the ruling party, which is no longer the ruling party right now. It's ruling in coalition with other parties, that is the ANC, right? But the ANC was always trying very hard to, in my sense, to turn the SABC in its own mouthpiece, which didn't quite work because, you you know, the broadcasters actually fought back against that. And one of the ways in which he tried to do that was to load the board of the SABC with members of the ANC, right? He tried to do that. But that has not actually worked well. But it's clear that it was just tried through bringing its own people into the SABC, one of whom actually became the CEO at some point, one of the former broadcasters of Radio Freedom, became the CEO of the SABC. He has since passed on. So I guess in the region, you know, there are different approaches. I think ZANU-PF has succeeded in Zimbabwe in terms of capturing the national broadcaster. The ANC has not succeeded in South Africa. The SABC continues to be a public broadcaster. Of course, others would argue that, in fact, this attempt to control the SABC by the ANC is still ongoing. But my sense is that, you know, the ANC has not succeeded in capturing the SABC. But yeah, broadcasting is something that continues to be, you know, fought over. So it continues. I guess the struggle continues in South Africa.
Se Kibakibo Petrom Lehgvatijem se je pogovarjal Tadej, lektorirala je Eva, tehniciral je Oli, brala sem Nina.
Repeticio iz Mater Studiorum. Repetirai.